Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions in the law. My name is Matthew Kerbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Amanda Carey. Amanda is the founder of the Carey Center for Justice, a law firm incorporated as a nonprofit. While this approach is innovative enough on its own for Amanda to stand out, she is, of course, using subscriptions as part of the way she bills her clients. Amanda shares some of the other interesting benefits of approaching delivering legal services through a nonprofit law firm, and is yet another Justice Entrepreneurs Project alum to come on the podcast. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later. And remember, use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast. You get 10% off, and it really supports the show. For subscriptionseminar.com, I'm taking firms off the waitlist one at a time in the order they signed up, so sign up now to get your spot in line. I'm an active participant in that process of helping you use the subscription model, so I can only work with so many at a time. Thank you for your patience. The podcast is finally getting more traction, so please rate and review it if you haven't already to help others discover the show. And as always, please share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode.
I'm thrilled to have with me today Amanda Carey, fellow Illinois attorney, who I heard on another podcast where attorneys are doing innovative things. And so I'm so grateful that you agreed to come on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So I've listened to that other episode on the Different Practice podcast, and I'll link to that in the show notes. But just in case my listeners haven't heard that one, give a little bit of background about yourself.
Sure. So I opened the Carey Center for Justice a few years ago, and we are a nonprofit law firm, which sometimes people think, oh my gosh, a nonprofit. But we really set out to serve the middle and the people who can't afford traditional hourly billing or $3,000 bill one month and $2,000 the next. So we figured that a nonprofit model would be best for both our clients and for myself and the people that will be working here.
So I really want to dig into that. But even before we do, is this like your first thing you've ever done as a practicing attorney? Or what did you do before that made you decide, you know, I have to do this nonprofit thing?
Yeah, so I came to the law later in life. I started out my career in higher education, and I was faculty, and I moved up to be a dean and eventually a president. And I realized at that point that I wasn't doing what I wanted to do anymore. I wasn't helping the students, those first generation college students that just needed help along the way. And I had always had a passion in the law. And so I decided I was going to go back to law school. And I went to kind of an alternative, I suppose, law school where it was distance. And before the pandemic, obviously that was very taboo. Now it's not so much, where we went in residence for a few weeks and had a couple grueling weeks in school. And then the rest was distance. And so doing a lot of these kind of alternative methods of things, I suppose that's really where the Carey Center was born. I didn't want to go to a law firm and churn and burn cases, making money for other people. That just didn't interest me anymore. I kind of did the rat race for a long time, and I wanted to leave that. So going just into another set in a different profession just didn't interest me at all. And so I've always kind of been that person to find something that's a bit more on the alternative and that people aren't necessarily 100% bought into. And so it just made sense for me. And also, my law school was very supportive of people going out of law school and starting their own practice. Obviously, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, you can't do this. And I still have people that are like, oh, you're going to get complaints and you're going to get, you know, do something that's against the rules or whatever. And, you know, so far, it's not without its challenges, but it's so much more rewarding to me than it is just punching a clock and going into work at 8 a.m.
Definitely. And and then having to keep track of all your time.
Right, exactly. I haven't done that since high school. I didn't punch a clock. And I'm not very good at it because I like to jump from one thing to the next, and I don't want to remember like what email I sent or what phone call I had. I just want to get this work done for clients and move on and be able to do things that I want to do as well.
And you don't need to remember because technology remembers for us. There's a record of
Right.
everything now.
Right,
So if you
exactly.
needed it, yeah, sure, you're not tracking your time. Like if you have to do a fee petition, I suppose, and the judge really wants to see what you've done, I suppose you could go to your email and your phone records and like collect that and see, right?
Right. And that's really the challenge that I find is kind of when I have to go back and justify what I've done. Judges, other attorneys, they're like, okay, well, how much time did you spend doing that? And I was like, well, does it matter? I did it. Right. I use technology to help me draft this petition where some attorneys would charge an hour or two or three doing that petition. It's something that I can use technology to get it done faster, more efficiently for the client, as well as the court system that we're working in. So why would we not do it better?
Right. We're really getting into the weeds. I still want to like get a little bit more background so the audience gets to know
Sure.
you a little better. So like with education, you said you had an education background and you really got high up there. Then pivoting and like going to be a student again. Like what was that like, and did it help like understanding at a meta level like how the education system works, even though law school is different than maybe the education, you know, that you were working in, but like did that give you a much like a useful perspective to pivot from educator into law student?
I suppose it was a little bit different because I don't know that I've ever really left education, because when I did do law school, when I did go back to law school, I was actually in the middle of my doctorate as well. And so I had been in my doctorate for a really long time, and my research focus, the other side of the Carey Center, I suppose, is looking at lawyer well-being. And so I conducted a national study of first year law students and their mental health distress that I know a lot of us look at. We have CLEs that are required on our mental health. And so I looked at depression, stress, and anxiety of first year law students and why kind of people are entering law school and they're seemingly okay and they're leaving law school and they are very much not okay. So when I transitioned into law school, it was more just of the same, except it was going into an educational environment that is not necessarily a supportive one or one that they're really looking to educate. It's more of a, put them into this particular box and we want you to come out a particular way. So I think moving from the profession of education and into going into law school was a relatively easy transition in the sense that I was used to being a student, but a difficult one in that it's so frustrating to me how we educate attorneys and how we keep kind of putting them in that box to be a certain way or to be a certain attorney, and moving kids, in essence, away from these kind of alternative career plans or to be creative attorneys to solve problems.
So you are both a Juris Doctor, I mean, and licensed attorney, but you're also a Doctor of Education. So does that make you a Juris Doctor of Education?
Yeah, I know some people in my signature line are like, you do realize a JD, you don't call yourself doctor. And I'm like, yes, but you do with an EDD.
But you are also a doctor. You're a doctor,
Yes.
Juris Doctor.
Sometimes judges get a little confused with that when sometimes opposing counsel will call me doctor in court and the judge is like, what are you talking about?
Us lawyers, we love to be, you know, to give deference, you know, when due.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, I've had people on the stand that are doctors. I make sure to refer to them as doctor. I see no reason why it wouldn't be the same with opposing counsel or collaborative counsel, depending on your perspective.
Right.
So you mentioned that your law school was supportive in your decision to start your own practice, sort of tying into everything that you were just talking about. And I'm curious, so what way was it supportive? Because a lot of the time, I think this is changing with U.S. news rankings being sort of disrupted now, but law schools wanted their students to graduate, pass the bar, and get a really good job because it helped them in the rankings and it helped them with recruiting. And having students who graduate and start their own law firms doesn't help them with that stuff. And so they're not really teaching you how to do it. So were they supportive teaching you, or were they supportive just, you know, in other ways?
So we had a class that we could take that focused on starting your own practice and being an entrepreneur, which most law schools don't necessarily offer. And if they do, it's really dependent upon their faculty and having like one faculty member that's really passionate about students leaving law school and being able to start their own practice. I was lucky in that Mitchell Hamlin did have that person. And she always said, you know, I wanted to start my own practice. And, you know, life took her on a different path. And she hasn't been able to do that quite yet. But she felt as though educating students helped her kind of accomplish that mission. And bringing in guest speakers of people who had started their own practice and common issues that they had faced and things that they were thinking of and the use of technology. So it was a really good course for me to take. But I think it also just encouraged me that like, this is possible. It's so much in your other classes of constitutional law and crib pro and all of these other things. They just focus on you kind of getting this big law job and, you know, that's the direction you need to go. But, you know, I think you're right with U.S. News and World Report basically blowing up because a few of the top law schools said, we're not going to play a game anymore. That is starting to change. Now we're looking at maybe even getting rid of the LSAT and having 25% of the student population not having to sit for the LSAT and be admitted anyway. And that push of the ABA and the accrediting body is really starting to make a difference. And I think ultimately it's going to end up making a difference in the health and well-being of our, not only our law students, but also our practicing attorneys. People aren't going to be put in this box that they don't necessarily want to be in, and they could really start to forge their own path. But I mean, I digress, but you know, kind of back to your question, I think it really just depends on having even just one faculty member that's that supportive voice and saying, this is possible and it's okay to forge a different path. It's okay to not have this facade of, you know, I got a law review and I did this. I remember being in law school and I, even with all this knowledge that I had about legal education, the system and kind of how we educate lawyers, I still sort of fell into this trap of wanting to do law review. And I was like, but yeah, but you need to do law review to get like a good job. And then I had my writing professor who was also amazing. She looked at me and she's like, Amanda, why are you doing that? She's like, what? You want to sit in a back room and check citations all day? What is that going to do for you? Yeah. And I'm like, well, yeah, I guess you're right. It doesn't. She's like, stop doing these things. I didn't go to a top tier law school. I didn't want to. So she's like, why are you doing these things? They're not going to accomplish your goals. And they're going to help you accomplish your goals. And so, but I had to be constantly reminded of that, even with all of the things that I knew that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredible mentorship from a professor the position that they were in. And I just think that we don't get enough of that in law school. Like your clients don't care if you were on law review. They don't care what your grades were. They care, can you solve my problem or help me avoid a problem? And how much does it cost?
Yeah.
Like that's all they care about. And maybe some clients care, you know, have they been sanctioned before? And they'll like look up your license to see like, you know, what,
right.
I mean, all clients should care about the latter part, but I'm like, a lot of them don't even care about that. They're just like, how much is it going to cost? Can you solve my problem? So yeah, I think that was incredible guidance that you received. So then you did have that guidance and you had that class in law school. But then I know that you were part of the JEP program, but what brought you to that program? How did you discover it? And then what was it like?
So in that class, somebody had mentioned incubators and I was always concerned about starting my own practice. I'm like, where am I going to find clients? That was always my biggest concern. Like, where am I going to find? How are they going to find me? Because I'm not a social media person. In fact, I hate doing those things. I don't care for marketing. I feel like, if you build it, they will come type of thing. It doesn't always work, but so I started researching incubators and I found the JEP in Chicago and I ended up going to a small conference for legal aid and the director was there. I did end up speaking with him and told him that I was interested in starting my own practice. He gave me his card and he said, "Oh, give me a call." And I never did, never called him. And I think I just got busy and I was like, "Okay, well, I'm just going to keep this in the back of my mind." And then after I graduated and passed the bar, I was like, all right, well, what am I going to do now? And I started just kind of looking for jobs on LinkedIn. And I saw this solo practitioner looking for an attorney. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to submit an application and see what happens. And I ended up talking to her, and she was a part of the JEP network. And she hired me. Started training me in family law. And about 3 months later, she encouraged me to join the JEP. And then she decided that she wanted to leave her solo practice. And so I basically kind of took over what she had started to build. And I went into the JEP. And then that's where the Cary Center came from. It was kind of I knew I always wanted to start my own practice, but I ended up falling into it anyway.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that is kind of an incredible sort of lucky happenstance that
It
JEP kept
was.
it kept rearing its head, join JEP, JP. And for those listening, we've talked about it before on I think on the third episode or fourth episode that I had where I had Jessica Bednarz and Lauren Lester on, and of course it was on Lauren's podcast that I discovered you. But it's Justice Entrepreneurs Project, and if you just search JEP Chicago, you'll the top link should be that, so you could look into it. Even the American Bar Association now has a page of all the incubators, or probably most of them. I don't know about all of them, in all the different jurisdictions where they're offered. And I mean, I've had a number of JEP alumni on this podcast because what they teach you there is really something. So you sort of lucked in,
Yeah, I did.
fell into a practice already, and while you're so like. If the incubator is like, let's start a practice, but you kind of got to adopt a practice and then innovate on top of it and obviously change the name. And was it a nonprofit at the time, or that was something that it morphed into, or you built a
Nope.
nonprofit and you transferred the assets or something? Like what was that process like?
So she kept some of her clients, and then I kept kind of the cases that I was working on. I had already incorporated the Cary Center months prior. I knew it was always the goal, and it was just kind of sitting there waiting for me to figure out, how am I really going to open the doors to this practice? And I was really nervous, not kind of understanding the law. I mean, we all know we graduate, we have no idea what we're doing. So when I had that cushion, I had a few mentors and another mentor at family law that had been doing it for like 30 years. And she's like, "Amanda, don't worry about it. I'm going to teach you everything you need to know." And sure enough, it started coming to me. And so when I incorporated back in 2020, and I was fully open by April of 21.
I mean, that's something. So then when you started working though for the other practice, like was that attorney billing on subscription or and flat fees and alternative fee arrangements already, or is that something that you learned in JEP?
She was also in the JEP network, so she was on a subscription model as well. And I was really lucky in that she was very open to change and testing things. So we constantly had conversations about, well, hey, let's do it this way, or let's try this, or how are we going to bill for trial, or how are we going to bill for this? And so we were able to test a lot of things. And after she moved on to her next position, I was able to kind of take that and say, all right, well, let's see if some of these things work. And sure enough, I was able to not only build a bigger client base, but also have enough sustainable income to hire a second attorney, which I'm looking for right now, and a legal assistant, plus myself. So, and I keep getting repeat customers, repeat clients, and people referring. So I think what we're doing is really working and resonating with people.
So, talk a little bit about some of the takeaways then that you learned in JEP that you applied and adapted to your own practice that were maybe different than the subscription model that you just kind of fell into that you were working on with the other attorney.
I think that the biggest thing that I took away from JEP was that there are so many resources out there to help lawyers in a subscription model. And there are so many different technology components that can assist in helping with problems that attorneys face on a daily basis. But I think the difficult part is evaluating that technology and making sure that it's actually going to work for you. JEP, they do an amazing job at introducing you to so many different technology pieces and what can help your practice. But it's really about that self-discovery, figuring out how you work and how you want to work, and then going to find that technology that's going to assist you in making that a reality. So JEP, like for example, demonstrated a lot of case management softwares. And as basic as that now is to attorneys. And I interviewed a lot of them and took a look, and I opted to choose one of them. And I ended up using them for about a year. And then I realized that, like, I'm spending all this money. I'm using the technology probably at 20% of what it's capable of, really. But what it's capable of isn't exactly what I need. But I was still trying to kind of pigeonhole myself into like, but this is what everybody says we need, and this is how it's going to work better. So ultimately, I took a leap and I said, all right, I'm getting out of this. So I'm not going to spend money on a case management system. I'm going to go into the Google Drive and I'm going to see how I can make that function. As a nonprofit, I get a number of things for free because of the way that we are incorporated. And so I have access to the Google Suite for free. And I'm like, why am I not just using this? And once I really started to look at it, I'm like, oh, well, I could do all of these things with Google that I was doing with my previous case management system, and I don't have to pay for it. So that takes away, the issue of having to pass any of that, those fees onto my clients for increasing profits. And so it just kind of made sense. But a lot of people ask, like, well, what case management system do you have? And they like the shiny new technology, myself included. But realizing that, like, there are resources out there that, one, you don't have to pay for, that technology is already doing, and figuring out where to plug in those various technology pieces that will assist you, what's valuable and paying for it, if that makes sense.
I think that makes sense. And I think just a through line with all the attorneys using the subscription model that I've had on here is just that there's something inside of us that inherently challenges the status quo, or at least makes us question it.
Yeah, I
Because
think
you're like,
so.
why do I have to use the like legal tech just because it's legal tech?
Right.
And legal tech is always like 5 times more expensive than everything else.
Right.
Apparently, it's infinitely more expensive if you're a for-profit law firm, or if you're a nonprofit and you don't even
Right.
have to pay for it. But even still, I use Google Workspace. $6 a month. It's not that
Yeah.
expensive.
Right, exactly.
And if I needed more like features and more storage space, it's $12 a month, which is double, but still, as a law firm, I feel like most law
Right.
firms can afford $12 a month. I do think there is a gap that needs to be filled. I do think it would be nice to have some features like that Google Workspace doesn't have that some of the practice management systems use. But I my like My CRM client portal software is not legal tech for that reason. And it's $150 a year. And so, I found a different solution. I'm still in Google Workspace a lot, but, it's nice to have a little something extra. So then That brings us into something that I sometimes call the segment of what subscriptions power your subscription law practice, because, you know, and I suppose if you're not paying a subscription, just any technology that you're using as a nonprofit, and maybe some of the other benefits of being a nonprofit law firm, you know, that you could talk about in that regard with technology. But like, yeah, what's all the tech that you are using?
So it's interesting because I feel like it's just now that I'm starting to feel much more comfortable with where the practice is at. And so I'm starting to explore different opportunities. Like, I feel like I've had enough clients now to really get an idea of what they need and what's not happening in the market. And so I'm actually planning on, I'm going down to San Diego in a couple of weeks to the Association of Talent Development, ATD, conference, which is a massive conference which has a ton of tech, but they focus on training and development and education. But they have so much tech in delivering information to people. And what better place to go than to educate people to find the tech that actually focuses on educating people as opposed to legal tech that kind of focus on the attorney side. So I'm going down there to kind of explore new technology and delivering information to clients that perhaps don't want to necessarily hire an attorney, but want to do some of these things themselves and start to educate the public on some of these practices that the counties just don't have the resources to explain to people: how to file for divorce, how to file for parental allocation, how to, you know, try to hold somebody in contempt, like basic things that are just kind of unreachable to the general population. So I suppose moving back to your question, so some of my tech is really, I like to explore more outside of legal tech and figuring out where those experts are and how I can either adapt what they are already doing or adjust what I'm doing to better accomplish those goals.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I use very little legal tech in my practice, but something that I think you should consider. And we're about halfway through the interview, so the ad spot will probably be coming up for this soon.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
That is Gavel. And you know, Gavel used to be Documate. Hello Divorce is powered by Gavel. And it lets you productize your services. So if somebody just wants to buy something, and even, you know, you're a nonprofit, so you might be able to do this a little bit more easily than for-profit law firms. So there's a lot of for-profit law firms will do like a Hello Divorce version where they spin off a separate entity to sell more affordable, just legal products with a DIY focus. But you could build out these automations there, and they have all these FAQs and how-tos and how to use their systems. And you could even hire somebody there to help you build it. And Law Subscribed gets you 10% off if you use that code.
Yeah.
So you're getting a savings by me letting you know about it, right? So, and I think they have a free trial too. So you could go and build something, play around with it, and see if it's something that you like. So like, and I've started to, of course, use it in my practice as well. So that's good for like practice side, like 'cause I'm using it in my practice to streamline processes. And then also I'm thinking about how can I also do what you're talking about, like how can I build things for clients or potential clients to DIY it, and then maybe they still want to hire me, right? Like after they've like tried to do it themselves and they're like, oh, this is too complicated, I'm just going to hire the lawyer. And because all my pricing is available on my website, they know exactly how much it's going to cost to hire me. So that kind of brings me to, to your pricing. And, how was it that you decided what your, value-based fees were going to be compared to your subscriptions? Are you doing pure subscription plays? Are you doing a hybrid subscription and flat fee? Like, what does your and fees are always subject to change, and so you don't have to actually give them here on the podcast because they might be different by the time this goes live. But like, just in terms of the strategy around building your model, what does that look like, and why did you make the decisions you made?
I mean, when just like when I had started with my original mentor, we tested so many different things. And at the end of the day, it just felt right. Things that we tried and then we're like, oh, we did way too much work for the amount of money that we charged. And then we like increased prices in that area. And I felt more comfortable with the amount of work that I was doing, or the amount I kind of look at it as like, this is the time I'm taking away from my family, and I want to make sure that it's worth it for the firm to for me to be taking that time away. And so we underprice things. I think sometimes we overprice things. And when it was only through time that I really started to discover like, this is what I'm comfortable charging for the time, the energy, the effort, and just kind of the support that I'm providing the client and doing those things. And I still adjust my prices on almost a daily basis. I have a lot of my practice serves a number of domestic violence victims. And so I also do talks at shelters. And so there are just some cases that I'm compelled to just say, okay, this is what I'm going to charge you because just frankly, you need the help. And money is not something that you have. But that's also why I'm a nonprofit as well. I want to practice that way. And this was not something that I went into saying, I'm going to make millions of dollars doing this. And this is how I'm going to go buy a Porsche and all these other things. That was never the goal. So it was really just a feeling that I got in testing things and understanding what I was going to do in particular areas in charging. So I do. For like a full representation, I do a case initiation fee and then a subscription per month charge. I also do limited scope where people call and they say, I cannot get my divorce finalized. I've done all of this paperwork, but the judge is still telling me that it's wrong. We get a lot of those cases. And so I just charge a flat fee and say, I will go in, I will do all of these things for you, and you can just send me everything and I will. Kind of take it off of your plate. And they're so relieved that they don't, that they can know exactly what they're being charged and not have to worry about the issue that's been plaguing them for months. And then I also will do just like drafting work for people, and that typically is just on a flat fee. And I still just kind of adjust that based on the communication that I have with the client. What I'm struggling with right now is figuring out how I'm starting to reach my capacity. And I like to talk to my clients. I don't like to practice where I'm just putting information into the computer and then it's going to spit out something and I'm just going to go file that. And then it's a very kind of clinical process. I like to hear my clients' stories, and I like to, when I need to, use them in court, but also just help them during this portion of their life. And so I price myself and my services based on that when I'm sending hundreds of emails and things like that, of just having conversations with them and telling them that things are going to be okay.
Yeah. In other words, you identify with the synonym for attorney often used, counselor.
Right.
Yeah, as do I. One of the things I do that you maybe you consider is I do even an entry level flat monthly price of $20 a month, and then that's communications with me. And then when they pay that, they get access to being able to pay my flat fee per page for drafting or analysis or whatever it is for contracts or letters or what have you. And so, so $20 a month, $50 a page. I'm not a nonprofit. Maybe you could do even better. Maybe you could go even lower than that, if depending on the market that you're trying to serve, because at least then you're getting some continuous income, even for those potentially one-off drafting things, because maybe they'll come back with other questions, other needs, because they're subscribed and they're staying subscribed to you. Outside of the subscriptions that you're clearly using for litigation, because it was case initiation plus month to month. My question for you on that is that month to month, are you putting that in an IOLTA account and transferring it at the end of the month? Is it earned on receipt? I mean, every jurisdiction's different, but like these are the questions I get from lawyers of like, how do I treat the monthly subscriptions?
Yeah, so in Illinois, they're earned upon receipt. So, and it very clearly spells that out in the representation agreement. And I think what's funny is like attorneys get caught up in so many of these regulations because we are so heavily regulated. The clients don't understand the difference. I mean, when you explain to them, when I do consultations and I say, "Have you ever hired an attorney before?" 90% of them tell me no. And so I say, okay, well, this is typically how it goes to hire a family law attorney. And they're surprised. They're like, but how can I figure out if I've got enough money for this if I never know how much the attorney is going to have to spend on this case, like how much time they're going to work on it. And I'm like, well, yes, that is the problem, right? And so they explain how the subscription model works. And they're like, so this is the price. That's it. That's all I need to worry about. And yes, that is all you need to worry about. And so, but as attorneys, we were like, oh, but what about this? And what about this? And the regulatory bodies, like, as long as we put that in the representation agreement, you identify what your state is requiring for your fees and how they're earned, then everybody is on the same page. That representation agreement is signed and everybody understands what their obligations are to each other. You should be okay.
And because even though, because depending on, I don't want anything to get taken out of context. You say that
Sure.
out of context, the clients don't care about earn upon receipt or not, but you're still disclosing, you're still doing all the things
Yeah.
like, but for all, to take it in another direction, clients are used to paying for other things the moment they get the thing,
Yeah.
and so they're not used to being charged in arrears for stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine if you didn't pay for the latte until after you got to drink it and then you paid for the
Yeah,
latte?
right. And it's funny because attorneys too, like, so when I think of it, because I've never been on a monthly or on an hourly billing system. So it's fascinating to me when I talk to billable attorneys and I'm like, how do you do that? Because like if an emergency comes up or something's done and the IOLTA is drained, you're just doing that work. And then you end up getting frustrated when you go back to your client and they don't want to pay any more money or they don't have any more money. And then you're now in this controversy with your client. That's where you end up getting a high amount of withdrawals on cases. And so I think there's so much the animosity that can develop when you're talking about money and then you've got people that are in a high emotional state anyway. So, I mean, like with my cases, I can count on one hand and really almost less than that on how many cases that I've withdrawn from, and they don't have to do with money. So, I just don't have those issues with my clients.
Are you like taking like monthly checks from them? Are they doing credit card, ACH? Like how are you processing payments?
So I do have law pay, and so they're able to pay via credit card or ACH, and then but most of my clients pay me via Zelle. And so, and it goes right into the operating account. And I have an IOLTA account in case I need to, have a spot to put some client's money that's not mine. But I think I've used it once. And I don't, I mean, I had to go, I actually had to go back and like, okay, what's that account number again? And it just makes it so much easier for me to deal with.
And LawPay has a monthly subscription, right? Or an annual subscription?
It does. Yeah.
All right, ready to save some money? Not a sponsor, at least at the time of recording, but this is going to publish many weeks from now. So this part might even be cut out if I get them to sponsor. But I use Gravity Legal,
I've heard of them.
and they do not charge a monthly fee. And they are set up to do processing fees out of your operating account and put the full amount into your IOLTA account. And so
That's
client
nice.
funds are not touched. Yeah. So
Yeah, that's really nice.
I have an IOLTA that I barely use, and I do have Gravity Legal for when I need to use it. And also, something to think about is Gravity Legal also lets you set up automatic subscriptions. They're built to power subscriptions, not like robustly, but they do integrate with Vdoo, which is like a SaaS product that helps you launch a subscription model for your law practice. And I've had the founder on my podcast for the very first episode of Vdoo, Kim Bennett. And so if you want more robust like features for that type of stuff, a knowledge base for your subscribers, all these things, Vdoo integrates with Gravity Legal. But if you just want to power subscription payments and you're lean or you're just getting started, they do all that. And they allow you to set up ACH transfers too, which have a lower processing fee than the credit card payments. So
That's
it's
really
definitely,
interesting. I'll have to
yeah,
look at that.
worth looking into for sure. And I'd be happy to make a connection to their CEO or president, or I forget what his title is, managing director.
Yeah.
I'll make the introduction for you.
Yeah, that sounds really good. LawPay is one of those things that when I had to quickly set up a lot of those things, like a bank account, I was like, oh, everybody's saying let's get on LawPay. And so I'm slowly kind of trying to reevaluate some of those things that I'm doing and how to maximize things that I'm doing right now.
Yeah, I think that will help you maximize and also save you the monthly fee.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
I think the credit card processing fee is like the same too. So like not only are you not paying a monthly fee, but I think if you are taking credit card payments, if you want to, it's like the same. I think it's like the same fee. So what's been your clients' like response to the way that you charge? Like I know you just said 90% of them have never even had to pay billable hour because they haven't hired a lawyer before. But have you gotten like even informal feedback on this really works for me? Like has it been mostly positive, some negative? What's been the client feedback on your model?
Oh, it's been amazing. So I do have clients that come to me from other attorneys, and I make it a practice. I don't take new clients that owe a significant amount of money to their previous attorney because I believe in karma. And so, but I do have a lot of people that call me and they're like, I just can't afford my attorney anymore. I really like my attorney, but I just can't do this. And I have a client who she has paid a significant amount of money for her divorce. And they tell me, I wish I had found you earlier. I wish I knew this existed. And I think that's part of my struggle right now is there are a small but mighty number of us that we are doing this work and we're doing great work, but it's not overpowering that billing by hour system quite yet. And there's got to be a way that all of us can kind of get together and be like, this is what we're doing. And there is a different way. There's an alternative way to pay for this legal service that you so desperately need. Because the clients that do come to me for previous attorneys, they almost second guess me once they're into like a second and third month. They're like, this is all I need to pay. Are you sure? And is there anything else? There's nothing else. And I just say, yep, this is our agreement. This is what you do. And it's inevitably the second or the third month. And then And then they get into a routine of like, okay, I pay in the first of the month and I'm done. And I can call Amanda when I need to talk to her and I can send her emails and she gets right back to me and it's great. And I don't need to worry about the financial side of it anymore. So I get amazing feedback from clients.
Yeah, so you sort of just touched on it, but second to last question is just like, what's included in the subscription? Like, what do they get?
Yeah, so for my family clients, it's everything except emergency motions are charged at another flat fee if they are filed or if I have to file them, and then trial is a separate fee. The nice thing about family law is I really do try to come to an agreement. And, most cases, as long as you don't have two super litigious clients, most cases want to settle anyway. So we don't really end up getting there. And when I do my consults, I always tell them, especially if I've got a really difficult case or highly contentious case, like there's a possibility that an emergency motion could be filed. And so you should consider that when you're thinking about budgeting. And oftentimes they're like, okay, that sounds fine. And I tell them about trial. And that I don't know what the trial fee would be because I don't know what the issues would be, or I don't know how much work would be involved. But I do know that I'll have that good discussion with you months in advance. Like, we're not going to schedule trial and then it'd be the next day. And they are really receptive to that. As long as you are upfront with your clients and saying, this is how this is going to work, they're very open to hearing those things and they don't really object to them. They're like, okay, this is what needs to be done on my case. And that trust then develops throughout that case.
Yeah, I feel like we could keep unpacking this more and more, and I do want to with you. So maybe 6 months from now we'll revisit and we'll have you back for a repeat, and we'll see where you are, and I really want to get into the nonprofit side of things too and how that even works. So, but my last question for you is sort of going outside of your own personal practice now. ABA data on the profession has shown that the legacy model for law firms, the billable hour, has failed women attorneys. It's failed attorneys of color. You know, while more women are going to law school than men, only 20% of them end up in like a law firm leadership role at your bigger firms, right? And retention is a big problem. And of all the attorneys I've spoken to on this podcast, there have been a few more attorneys that look like me who are using the subscription model, but the vast majority are women attorneys of color, and attorneys of color. They make up the largest percentage of attorneys using the subscription model or alternative fee arrangements. So my question for you is, why do you think that is, first of all? And also, I mean, is this, and maybe this touches a little bit on your research on, improving mental health and why, that's a good thing that the women and the attorney and people of color attorneys are doing this. So why is it? Why do you think that that is? And the profession's broken and it shouldn't be, but we're just looking at data here and discussing it. So what are your thoughts on that?
You would need another a million hours to really unpack all of that. But I think what it boils down to is that, any model that is so rigid in its not only its delivery, but also its service is not going to meet the needs of the people that are working within it. I think that's why we see so much distress in the profession. I think that's why we see so many people leaving the profession. And just, how many times have you seen people post on social media or just groups where lawyers are around and they're like, I can't take it anymore? But there was a reason that we went to law school. There was a reason. There's a few people that are just like, oh, my parents told me I should go be a lawyer. And so I showed up here in law school. But for the most part, we all went to law school to help people and in whatever capacity that is. But clearly, the model that we have adopted millions of years ago and decided that we just want to keep perpetuating, we're going to keep, beating our head against a wall and saying, this is going to work. That model is just, it's not working for everyone. And so when you see minorities, people of color, women leaving this, It's because it doesn't work for everybody. There's one very specific group that it works for, and I would argue that it doesn't work for them either. But they've managed to just, kind of close their eyes and push forward. And I think finding these alternative methods are becoming more and more popular. And eventually, we will be able to break some of that system, at least crack it a little bit.
I hope so. That's what I'm trying to do with this podcast. And not to put anyone in a box or any gender in a box, but I do think, women have greater EQ, than men. And society puts more pressure on women to do stuff at home, even if you have spouses. Like, I try to be an ally and try to be as involved as I can be, but I know my wife has like feels all this extra pressure, even though I try to help as much as I can. And so women attorneys, that they get that too, and then they try to be efficient in their work as lawyers, they're penalized with the billable hour. So that's why I mean that's just my take on it. But yeah, like you said, we could have a really long conversation about this, just this topic. But I like to leave it just for the end. And I'll do a compilation episode in the near future of everyone's answers. My actual last question for you, Amanda, is a hot dog a sandwich, and why?
Is a hot dog a sandwich? No, a hot dog is a hot dog because it's not, I mean, it's between two pieces of bread, but they're connected. And I feel like a sandwich has to be disconnected to actually be a sandwich.
What if my bun is two different pieces, but it's still in the shape of a bun and there's a hot dog in between it? Is that a sandwich?
Well, then it's broken. And you couldn't eat that because then it's broken. Like, how depressing is it if your hot dog bun is completely broken? Then what are you putting in it?
If I slice a hot dog in half and then in half again, long ways, and put it in between two regular slices of bread, is that a hot dog sandwich?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, maybe. It depends on what your criteria is for a sandwich, right? Every person would be different in figuring. Is that just a typical lawyer answer of it depends? That's awful. I shouldn't give you that answer. Don't know.
These are the questions of our day and why people come to Law Subscribed. With that, Amanda, thanks so much for coming on the show. Where can people get in touch with you?
So they can find me at thecarycenter.org and also via LinkedIn.
All right, links to those in the show notes. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.